It's the 28th of May. Still not super ready to talk about the Bucks. Maybe next month, although I'm sure perhaps we'll touch on it a little bit. But Top Gun Maverick, man. Top Gun Maverick, every once in a while, like, you get kind of blown away by something that's just a fastball right down the middle. And so we had to go to the bullpen and call. The baseball analogies is just like, do you feel so? Adam McGee is here. I don't think, like, he's been on 20 times. I don't think you need the really big, list of accomplishments or all that kind of stuff. How's the transition to baseball guy going? I mean, you seem pretty authentic though, as it looks right now. I got the great big Brewer shirt, and cruising for a bruising seems to be going well. Yada yada yada. Like we'll touch on it for a second, but we gotta talk Top Gun. Adam, Top Gun, go. Top Gun.
Top Gun or Top Gun Maverick? Come on, it's your podcast. You tell me where you want to go.
I want you to go. Top Gun Maverick. Top Gun, Top Gun Maverick, Obi-Wan, Bobby Portis. Whatever you want to say first. Now, this is a Rorschach test. What do you want to say? Talk about first.
Top Gun Maverick's great. That's what I think we should say first.
It's great.
It's legitimately great. We've been talking kind of back and forth for the best part of a week in advance of this. And I was sharing some thoughts I had about the original, which I'm sure we'll get into. But had heard the rumblings that this film was kind of good, like really, really good. Still, you know, until you see it for yourself, you don't know what's that mean. Is that just like people who are completely in love with the idea even of the original more than the original itself? Is it just capturing something that's purely nostalgia? And no, it's not. I mean, I think it hits most of those kind of marks. It checks those boxes early on that for people who want to go and they want to see Top Gun, they're going to get that out of it. But it moves beyond that. And for me, I've been thinking about it quite a bit since I've seen it. It's a few days. I saw it on Wednesday. And I think Mad Max Fury Road is the only studio blockbuster better than it in the 2000s. Clearly better. And then you get into a mix of, like, it's maybe behind The Dark Knight, but not by much for me. Mission Impossible Fallout in the mix as well, which I think is interesting. Obviously, the crews of this and Christopher McQuarrie involved here as well. But it's really striking when you see this movie and you see just how well executed it is, how rare it is to see this kind of film, one, just be made, but two, to be as good as this actually is.
So that's really interesting to me because I loved it. Look, we both loved it, so we both loved it. We can talk a little bit about why. By the way, we're going to talk about the movie, so we're going to spoil. Like, Goose is dead. We're spoiling everything. Goose is dead. We're spoiling Top Gun 1, Top Gun 2, whatever else we talk about. You know, my basketball brain, I think, is more sort of anally about listicling things and being like, okay, you can say Ray Allen's better than Reggie Miller, but you can't say he approaches, you know, Kobe or whatever it is. And it's like, okay, praise him too much, but A, he's not better than Olajuwon or any kind of thing like that. But my brain does not work that way with movies at all. So it's interesting because I never would have even thought about this in the context of Dark Knight or any of these other kind of things. Of course. So were you always like, we're going to get right back to it, but were you always like this, or is this the Letterbox station of your brain, or was your brain just waiting for something like Letterboxd to kind of do that?
Always like that. I'm like that in every facet of my life.
Everything. Okay.
Not necessarily like always ranking things, although, yeah, I think part of that comes out of any kind of like fanatical sports fan. And I'm that since I'm like 4 or 5 years old. The sports have continued to evolve and new ones have been added along the way, but it hasn't really changed the way I process that. So there's probably part of that that comes to movies. I'm someone who I'm fanatical. We've actually talked about this on podcasts before. Many of my favorite films tend to be about obsession, and there's certainly a reason for that. So no, it's not just that, but I think it's not something I think about very often when I go see a big blockbuster, because for people who've not heard me on the pod before, don't know anything about me, I watch a lot of movies, and I don't mean that in like, I watch quite a few. I mean, I watch a lot of movies. I watch very close to, you know, most things that get released on a wide release, on kind of smaller arthouse independent runs throughout a year. And it's just kind of felt like generally for this kind of movie, and particularly for this kind of movie that's not like a comic book movie,
yeah,
one, there aren't a whole lot of them, but it feels like there's just a ceiling on that, and kind of going in, my expectations are generally capped at a point where I do think Mission Impossible is the only thing that I go into and I'm like, well, this, you know, potentially could hit this kind of heights. There has been a possibility of that with Bond films in recent years too. Some of the Bond films have hit that kind of really high mark where you're like, oh, this is going beyond something which you're like, oh, this is just a really good popcorn movie. But it's rare to see something that is like, that the craft is there, like is the case with Top Gun Maverick. And it's just like, widest possible audience, everyone can enjoy it. Like, it's maybe the most difficult thing to do in movies, and in part because they don't try all that much anymore. So it kind of, that part of my brain kicked in more for this than it would for, I don't know, whatever the replacement level version of this has been for the past 10 years, because I think it's very difficult if you've been watching. And I think this is like, this is the kind of movie that made everyone go to the theater all the time, made everyone be like, I'm going to the movies this week. What's out? That whole idea of that has died out over time. It was built around movies that were this kind of mass audience, everybody's going to love it experience. So when you see it, it does make you think of, like, what has had anywhere close to the critical acclaim, the universal approval from audiences? Like, it's already taking off in a box office sense. It's just, it's a really big movie in every possible way, and they come along very, very rarely now.
In a way, it's 80s. I mean, as a child of the 80s, growing up with the... I mean, I suppose if you say four quadrant, it kind of implies something else in kind of the Jurassic Park kind of sense. But I just mean, like, in an E.T. kind of sense, almost, just as a everyone... I mean, you just said everyone's going to like it. I'm actually kind of surprised, I'm going to lean on you a little bit with this. And I had heard some of the buzz. I've kind of been off. I don't think I've tweeted since the Bucks, and I've kind of been off Twitter, but, you know, I check in and stuff. So I heard this was going to be really good, but I didn't like Rob Liefeld said it was great. Randomly, like the comic book creator, different people were saying, you know, but the Access people, I couldn't trust anyway. But like, if some random guy who, like the guy who created, you know, Deadpool and the New Mutants is like, this movie is awesome 10 days ago, I'm like, oh, okay, that's interesting. But what does that mean? Because again, I'm in the tank for Top Gun 1. So I was like, oh, okay, so this is gonna be as good as Transformers 1 or something like that to me, where I'm like, oh, I had fun with this stupid movie. Mm-hmm. And what we immediately, at least the little back and forth that we had when I was kind of walking out of the theater a little bit, the first thing I said walking out, I'm walking out into the tunnel and it's getting brighter. And I just said to my wife, how is Tom Cruise doing this? Like, he's weaponized nostalgia in a way that it makes me think of Stallone in a way. And I know you're not as big on Creed or some of the, like, it was almost like I felt like Stallone was kind of reaching for some of this with Rocky Balboa and just kind of reaching for this. Hey, I've made all these characters, I'm going to comment on these old characters, and always kind of had a desire to do it. And this Cruise thing. So this was a thing well before, like, I never actually saw Days of Thunder, but around the time of Days of Thunder, the commentary around Cruise was, he's the best at every movie. He goes through the hero's arc in every movie, but he's the best sports agent. He's the best fighter pilot. He's the best NASCAR driver, whatever, you know, and that became a thing that was said. And even, I think if you talk about how later on, like the, you know, like the Will Smith approach to making movies, I'm going to be in movies with aliens or whatever. And there was kind of an idea that people understood how to imitate Arnold or how to imitate any of these other kind of guys. But the Tom Cruise thing now, I mean, again, I feel like this movie is likable characters, incredible stunts, practical stunts. Ed Harris. I'm running out of stuff to say because again, you just talked to my brother-in-law and I said, look, everyone's going to tell you it's awesome. It's really, really good, but going with low expectations. So I guess what I'm asking you, who are far more learned than me on this, is like, why is this so good? Because I saw it once. The theater wasn't great. I could literally hear Doctor Strange to the left of me in the other theater. Like it was kind of rumbly but you know, I was trans, but like so subtly or just anything you want to say, like, why is it so good? Because I acknowledge that it was really good, but I kind of got swept away with it. And I can't really articulate why you would even say Dark Knight next to a Top Gun movie.
I just think it is genuinely on that kind of level of achievement for what it is. Okay. And that's probably... it's probably a key point to make here. I try to not just treat every movie on like one steady curve, you know, because there are certain things that you're going to say, oh, well, that can only ever be this good. Like there is a level that I think, you know, you could have an art house movie that is made by a master director that is technically on a level far beyond a lot of other stuff you see. But I don't think it's right to be like, well, that's 5 stars. That's the only thing that can be 5 stars. You can have a 5-star action movie. You can have a 5-star comic book movie. I think this is right up there as The Dark Knight was for comic book movie making as to what the adult comedy drama big summer blockbuster is. And particularly in a modern sense where that's kind of just died. Like, the interesting thing here for me is this is intellectual property, is a Top Gun sequel. I think for the most part, the movie does a really good job of not just being a Top Gun sequel. And I know that's something that Cruise supposedly was very intent on, which I think is interesting. I think there's a lot of things that came out of Top Gun that as much as it was really the movie that pushed Cruise as like A-list, big budget blockbuster movie star number one, like into a different stratosphere, there was also a lot of stuff that came out of that movie that I don't think he liked and that followed him around, became part of his character, became part of the media idea around him. And with that, I think there's some really interesting departures in this movie that shocked me most of all because they kind of do away with the things I just hate from the original that I think are really, really just bad as pieces of filmmaking.
I can't even imagine what those.
I'll give you one straight away because I don't think this is the biggest reason this one is like this is a great movie, but I do think it's something that is a major, major upgrade. The soundtrack from Top Gun is iconic. Everyone loves the soundtrack. It is terrible as a piece of movie music. It is so persistent, suffocating. Cannot move from Kenrod. That is not. It's not how
I can't hear
movie
you.
Music should be. I have no connection to any character, to any supposed emotion from the original film. It's not there because no moment is allowed to breathe. So the interesting thing that happens in this film is Harald Faltermeyer, the composer of, like, don't get me wrong, the iconic team from Top Gun, so many great motifs. He is back working on this movie. Who is also working on this movie? Hans Zimmer, right? And you can hear the spots where Zimmer is coming in. It's often some of the more understated scenes. I mean, we'll maybe get specifically into plot and spoiler stuff a bit later. But for example, the Val Kilmer scene, you can hear Zimmer coming in there. Yep. And there is music, but it is real film music. And there is room for the film to breathe and to just operate on a level that you actually care about the characters. I cared, like, this film is entirely around the central relationship from the first film, you know? Goose is not here, but this is a film about Maverick and Goose. I do not care about Maverick and Goose going into this film. Could not care less. By the end of this film, I care because this film actually allowed it to have more meaning retrospectively by picking its spots. I think the music is just one example. For as iconic as the music is in Top Gun, it's everything I hate about film music. It's just, it's persistent. There is not a moment to breathe. And ultimately, it's like, if you've got that much music, have you got any music at all? It just, I find it really grating. Beyond that, though, you've got Jerry Bruckheimer back, who, one of the greatest producers of these kinds of films. No one can say Jerry Bruckheimer doesn't know how to do this. Tom Cruise has clearly proven he understands how to make these films that are, as you said, really products of the 80s, and in this particular case, it really is, but how to make it in a way that fits modern movie making and modern movie going audiences, even the people who don't usually go, he can get them to come out. Part of that is Christopher McQuarrie, too, who now is really his go-to director on Mission Impossible movies. He's one of the best big studio writers around. So Christopher McQuarrie coming in and having a screenplay and a producing credit here is not insignificant. And in parts, I think this movie looks and feels like a Mission Impossible movie. Joseph Kosinski, the director, pretty interesting in that he's not a named director, but he is someone that Cruise has worked with before, and Cruise is not working with many directors now. He has gone past the days of, like, I want to work with Kubrick and Paul Thomas Anderson, Steven Spielberg, and he is very much now in the mode of, I want a few guys who are, like, capable technicians, but they're not going to overrule me or other key creative voices on the film. And Kosinski is that, but Kosinski, there's something there. Like, there is something there. I don't know if you saw Only the Brave, the movie about firefighters in Arizona fighting wildfire. I think it came out in 2017. Very good movie, directed by Kosinski. And you can kind of feel, like, where he's coming from to arrive at Top Gun from that. I think his feature debut was Tron Legacy, which is not something that you imagine getting to this point. But with all of that, I think this is a better written movie. Script is better. Tony Scott is a better director, a more skilled director than Joseph Kosinski. But Kosinski is doing a lot of stuff here that is really simple for a movie about planes. I don't know if anything struck you about just how it looks, how the flights look. Is there anything it, like, if I'm talking about when they're in the cockpit, we're getting kind of, if it's Tom Cruise, we're just looking at Tom Cruise's face and he's flying. Yes. There is an element of this that is different and is certainly used a lot more in Top Gun Maverick than it was in Top Gun.
No, go for it though.
It's just much more classical. It's much more classical war movie. And with that, it looks much more like Star Wars. It's much more like Star Wars. They put this down to that the technology wasn't there because of camera size at the time when the original was made. So Tony Scott wouldn't have been able to get the positions for his camera in the cockpit of the plane to get those real shots that they can now. But I just think everything on the planes just looks so much better, so much more dynamic. And it makes you invested in that where,
You're right. I'm thinking about it. Yeah, you're right. Because and what actually makes me think of it is because in Top Gun 1, the MiGs, like when you get like Tom Skerritt dead ahead, and it's kind of like got the triangle cross section. So there is the dead ahead shots. They kind of see your, you know, you're looking through the window of kind of what they can get dead ahead, and obviously canopy shots and everything like that. It's funny, and I know I cut you off. That would be full circle then, because like the whole idea, I mean, this was a Spielberg thing too, but like the Lucas, you know, looking at old war movies to storyboard Star Wars, right? And all those guys kind of did that stuff. So that makes sense.
100%. And I think one other thing that is crucial and is different again to the original, and part of this, like, let me see, the original had a $15 million budget, which is obviously a lot more money back then, but we're still not talking about a mega budget movie where this is $170 million. Like it is a different ball game in terms of what they're able to do with the scale that's there to begin with, because at this point, Top Gun is like a name property and it's the next movie that Tom Cruise wants to make. This film just has set pieces though. and it has multiple set pieces from the very beginning of the movie, where it has an amazing Mission Impossible-esque set piece.
Yeah.
It has like 4 to 5 sequences that are just gonna, as an audience member, like you're gripped, you're there, you're holding onto the arms of your chair, and you're like, okay, I'm fully invested in this. And that also makes a lot of the, you know, a lot of the nods to the past that aren't even nods to the past. I mean, you get overt references like when Miles Teller's, you know, playing the piano and everyone's there, and the whole dynamic between Miles Teller and Glenn Powell, and it's like, yeah, okay, well, that's Goose's son, and this is clearly the new Iceman. Like, yeah. All of that is there, and that works, but it does ultimately work all the greater because the payoff is big. Like, when you get to those sequences, I think the stakes feel much greater than they ever felt in the original, and that is down to the filmmaking. And the interesting thing is, it's not down necessarily to, like, what the answer would usually be for most movies now, which is like, oh yeah, so you can do so much more with VFX. Like, this movie is largely practical. Like, it's probably 90% practical, and they've talked about that and taken kind of a lot of pride in that. So yeah, they've benefited from cameras being smaller, but you're also like, I don't know, did you feel that? But I think it is something maybe that a lot of audience members are going to feel, which is, Not to like knock Marvel movies, but if people who go to the movies all the time, which, you know, the numbers tell us, the people who are going to the movies, they're showing up for Marvel movies most often, really. That's what it is now. This is an event movie they might come out for. This looks different. Like,
it looks different.
It's gonna look different. It's down to having the actual practical effects work in place and just being like, how can we get this in the camera? The cinematography is really good. They do the thing that also, again, like, one of the things I would take from Top Gun is Top Gun, the idea of let's try and shoot around sunset as much as possible. And it's always kind of this orangey color. They bring that true, but they add some kind of interesting wrinkles to it. I think it's a really well-made movie. Like, something like the editing then too, where Top Gun in classic 80s fashion is just like, oh, it's drowning in slow motion and like unnecessary slow motion.
When we I get love slow motion here, slow motion.
It's like, it's purposeful. It serves a point. And like, I love all of the kind of the tricks that are there one place or another in Top Gun. But in the original, it always felt to me, they're there just for the sake of, we're just going to do stylish things to make it stylish, but none of them actually serve a distinct purpose. I think there's just much more discipline to this movie. And that speaks to Cruise and his whole persona now. And I think it pays off.
Yes. The late Cruise persona now, though, I don't think it was out there to the same way. So like you said, it's all practical except they sweetened it, or there was other stuff that was done. Maybe it's the explosions. I don't really know. But like, did you get the message from Tom Cruise at the beginning of the film? Like, hi, my name is Tom Cruise. We made this movie for you. Hope you guys like it. That kind of thing. Did you get
that? No. Did you get that?
No, we got a billion previews. And then it's like, hi, I'm Tom Cruise. We're happy to have you back here in theaters. We flew these, you know, P-51 Mustang. We flew these planes. We did it. We're very proud of this movie that we made. We hope you guys all loved it. Like, it was just like a weird cut in. And then, you know, and then Paramount, and then right to the Paramount stars. So medium Cruise. So, and I love cheese. Like I can talk about an intelligent mm-hmm. movie, and I can try to hang. I can't hang with you, but I can hang with most people. But I love cheese. Like, there's nothing. I unironically love Mission Impossible 2. It was the craziest thing I had ever seen. And I had never seen Tandy Newton before either. But it was just like, what is this? What, there are doves flying. This is just insane. He's doing Guile Street Fighter kicks and he's riding a motorcycle. Like, the stunts hold up. But even at that point, and you know, that starts with him climbing whatever mountain in Utah or Arizona. And I was blown away by it. And even in 3, where he jumps off a building, I don't think the legend had quite caught up. If somebody said something about Tom Cruise, they would have said 100 other things, or they would have said he sprints in every movie. But around the time of Mission Impossible 4 or 5, it really started catching up that, yo, he's actually really doing all of this. And I think that's part of the draw. And so I don't really care. Cinephiles like you might break it down, but I think the general average dude going to the show knows I'm going to a Tom Cruise movie now, and he did all of this.
Yeah, yeah, for sure. And he makes everyone else do it. Like, that's the crucial part of this too. It's like, it's not just, more so than Mission Impossible, it's like, it's not just, oh yeah, Tom Cruise, you know, that plane is really flying. It's like, no, everyone was having to fully go through this because this is how he works.
I'm not become a trailer Nazi as far as not watching them. Probably bad choice of words, but like I've gotten away. I didn't watch any of the Obi-Wan trailers. Like, I'm just getting away from it. If I see them, my kids are still really in a Jurassic Park, and I watch kind of certain stuff, but I watched the first 10 seconds of the Elvis trailer or whatever, but I'm like, I'm kind of getting away from it. And also I'm not at the show that much. I'm going to watch them all if I'm at the show, but I don't want to know. I just don't want to see the cool shots.
I get that. There's a difference. Like, I see most of them in theaters, but I don't really seek out on YouTube or Twitter. It's like, oh, that trailer dropped, let me watch it on my phone.
Right. Not since Endgame for me did I stop what I was doing at work to do that. And so the Mission Impossible, whatever they're calling it, trailer was before Top Gun. And it just kind of struck me. And of course, it's been Ving Rhames. I mean, it's been this cast, but it really informed how I kind of thought about this one because you got to understand too, this is what I always kind of wanted for Denzel. You know, Denzel's this.
The Cruise path? Is that what you're?
Well, you know, it's not like I'm saying he doesn't do action, but I always felt like, okay, he's this great actor and I want to see him with five other great actors. I don't want to see him just with Ethan Hawke. Or just with One and a Half Guys, or just, I mean, there's Jodie Foster. There's always someone there. There's always good actors, but I want to see him in some other big director's movie, not him running game with like a bunch of other solid kind of New York based actors or whatever. But I always wanted a little bit more for him than kind of the zone he was in when he was kind of more or less popular. Like, I don't really watch any of these Equalizer or whatever these movies are, but like, you know, I know of this stuff that he's doing. It was the ensembleness of Mission Impossible kind of, because then I come out of Top Gun and I'm just wondering how his crews keep doing this. But when you think about Mission Impossible, he's in an unrequited relationship. There's this big ensemble of other kind of people. He gets to be kind of likable. He's noble in this other kind of way. It's a sexless kind of thing for the most part. It's just weird how he's point guarded kind of the whole thing in a lot of these kind of movies. And yet everyone knows that it's a Cruise joint, right? Like, everyone knows that he kind of steps back to be put forward in a way that I think is kind of interesting, which is bearing the elephant in the room, which is just like, this is just an technically incredible, interesting movie with incredibly interesting, likable characters. Like this dude, Glenn, like, we didn't talk about this. This dude, Glenn Powell.
He's a superstar.
Oh my goodness! I'm glad we agree on this. I was like, "What am
I
watching?"
You've heard about you. I know you've heard about him before. Now, listening to my movie podcast many moons ago, and actually, we're gonna make a comeback very soon, and we're gonna be talking about him again.
Tell him the name of that podcast.
That's Captured in Celluloid. Is a movie podcast host by myself and my friend Andrew Snyder, also a frequent guest on this particular podcast. Glenn Powell first came on my radar and Andrew's radar in Richard Linklater's baseball college comedy, Everybody Wants Some. And that's kind of an interesting movie because it's like a lot of Linklater movies, like most Linklater movies made on a small budget. And really, it was all kind of unknowns, up and comers. And it's already something that you can start to see. Not that everyone is like a star out of it, but you can see people who are on the rise and you're like, oh, okay, that person is now showing up in more and more movies. That person's got their own TV show. Just a really, really cast, a great movie. I can't sing the praises of Everybody Wants Some enough. Really fun movie. Glenn Powell in that movie, and in a movie with a lot of people where you could say it to one extent or the other, he just pops off the screen. I think the interesting thing is, like, Top Gun Maverick is essentially 3 years in the can. Like, when we talk about the buzz, too, I was thinking of seeing critics tweet about having seen it, like, 2 years ago, because they did screenings and they had dates in mind, but it was embargoed, so there was never any reviews. you never got a sense if it was good or not. You just knew that, okay, well, people are seeing this from a long way out. And it's not a case that they were working on it and they went back and they took another look at it. This movie has been done. This movie, they had offers from streamers in the middle of the pandemic being like, we'll give you, I would imagine, quite a lot of money for Top Gun Maverick. And Cruise was like, no way, this is playing in theaters. And being Cruise, you know, he could say that and he could stick to that, and that's going to pay off in a pretty big way. But the interesting thing, because Glenn Powell is someone I knew he was in this, didn't know to what extent his character was going to factor in. But you look at his filmography and you're like, hasn't he doing a whole lot? And doesn't even necessarily have a whole lot on the books yet. And you just think that's going to change in a hurry. Like, it must have killed his agent to be like, to have seen this, say, 3 years ago, and be like, oh, this is there. It's ready to get out there. Nobody knows yet. Nobody's seen how good it is. He has a kind of movie star magnetism and charm that I have not seen from too many kind of up-and-coming actors in a long, long time. He just seems like someone who should be an A-list star. And honestly, I'm kind of curious as to what the success of this movie turns into, and if they decide to make more Top Gun movies, because like, I think him and Miles Teller, like, as centerpieces, you could do that if Cruise is happy to kind of let it go that way going forward. There is a path to that, but yeah, 100% agree. He is a star.
I don't have anything smarter to say than he gives great face, but you're watching this and you know, it's the bully role, but like, even like, It was compelling to watch him saunter around, poke people in the chest, like do this like three-layer smile thing that he was doing. And I'm like, so it wasn't really a bully performance so much. It was like, you like the guy immediately. Like, yeah. You like every single fighter pilot immediately in this whole, it was just an incredible thing to see. I mean, Jennifer Connelly, like, no duh, but like just everyone who's on the screen.
But that's been a while, right?
Yeah.
So her career had basically like just fallen off completely. And then Joseph Kosinski cast her in Only the Brave, that Firefighters movie I mentioned earlier. Miles Teller also in that. So then when he got this job, there are two people he obviously brought into it. But like, that again is something that when you think of from the first one, although that's it's tough one to wrap your head around, because when you've got so many true lines in the first one, and then for a variety of reasons, then you've got a character who was notable in the first one who's nowhere to be seen. And instead, I believe references made to Penny because she's the Admiral's daughter in the first one.
Penny
she's
Benjamin. Penny yeah. Benjamin. Dude,
sure.
So,
I'll take your word for it.
So it's crazy how much I could probably recite that movie by heart. Sands, like you know, like passes over, you know, how many towers and one admiral's daughter, Penny Benjamin, and you're lucky to be here. Thank you, sir. And you, Maverick, that, you know, like I know that movie by heart without having to know it by heart. And yes, Penny Benjamin is thrown away by, you know, the principal from Back to the Future and whatever that scene is at the beginning, you know. But I didn't make that connection. They kept saying Penny. I didn't make that connection until the credits to actually see it. And I'm like,
But
they tied it in.
The upgrade from Kelly McGillis to Jennifer Connelly, like that is also a factor, just in terms of someone to act off of. And I don't know how much we'll be talking about. I think Cruise is really good as in a performance in this movie. I think it's something that just doesn't get talked a whole lot about when a new Mission Impossible comes out or whatever. And there's always this thing of it would be, you know, how it would come about more and people would talk about it a lot more is if he just once decided like, oh, you know what? I am going to do like another Paul Thomas Anderson movie. I'm just going to do one movie where it's like, I'll go and I'll get awards buzz and people start to consider me as the actor again. Mm-hmm. But it feels like because he stepped away from that, all the conversation is around, he does his own stunts and all of this is going to be authentic. But that phase of his career where he does Eyes Wide Shut with Kubrick, he does Magnolia with PTA, he does multiple Spielberg movies, and then it kind of works its way through. Like, he clearly improved massively as an actor over that spell. Where again, I know I watched Top Gun the night before going to see this, and okay, I don't like it as a film, but I was also struck by it's like two entirely different Tom Cruises. Like, yeah. he can handle the emotional beats so much better at this point in his career than he could have then, which is another thing that I think, just like for me, I'm like, yeah, well, this is a better movie, and it's elevated to a certain level, because not only have you got one of the best action stars in the history of cinema, which is what Tom Cruise is at this point, but he's there and able to more than hold his own as an actor.
So correct me if I'm wrong. I mean, really, this is not a baked take. So tell me, like, this with anything I say, tell me I'm wrong. I mean, that's what this is. It would seem to me, and I did think this in the scene with Val Kilmer, I had this half baked thought, because you're right, right? Like the scene in whatever movie he's at the bed, and because acting is not, at least to me, this is just always my thought, that, you know, every actor, of course, wants to cry. Because it's compelling for us to watch somebody cry. Of course, crying cannot be the only thing of acting, but like, that's the thing, right? That's kind of the bar, to see somebody, you know, in an unbroken take cry. And I feel like what's the movie where he's like shaking his fist and I'm just rooting for the tears to come out. You can tell he just wants it so bad. Maybe it's Magnolia, but like, there's one of these movies and he's just, and I think, like you said, I think he's out of Oscar mode now. So then you're just watching. And I had the thought in the Kilmer scene and in other scenes that just his kind of reaction, his pensive kind of look this way, look that way, think. And I feel like he really emotes well. And I still, he might just not be a crier, but I feel like now he's just so likable. And again, writing wise, just the perfect way, because we spoiled whatever. Like, I thought the perfect way to end that scene was like, hey, we've had a great moment, let's not spoil it. And but I just thought it was, I just feel like he's come a long way. But I did notice he can do the red eye thing, but he still really can't weep. And I think that's probably just like genetic.
I think he owns that better though, and he knows not to not to force his way into that.
Yes.
And he is someone, not just as an actor, but as a person, his whole persona. He is known for like the big zany energy. He's known for, you know, jumping on Oprah's couch. And there is something that I think in this stage was great. You do see where he doesn't go there. He doesn't go to that place. I actually think the most interesting part of this movie for me is it's the first movie. And I honestly, I don't know if he'll do this again, like within a point where it's unavoidable. I don't think we're going to see this in the Mission Impossible movies anytime soon, particularly because they've shot two of them. They're shooting back to back. So what happens here that I don't think is going to happen in the next Mission Impossible movie is, this is a movie about Tom Cruise becoming old. This is a movie about Tom Cruise being, you know, 60 years old in a couple of weeks, I believe. It's like a classic Western. He is like the old gunslinger coming to town. And he is not the movie star that you would imagine kind of readily coming to that place himself, where he's like, let's do Top Gun 2. And you mentioned Sylvester Stallone earlier, and when, you know, obviously Creed, that carries on. But if you think of like Rocky Balboa, which is a weird hybrid of this, because it's one part him acknowledging he's the old guy now, and it's another part him trying to keep it going in the way that it used to be.
And trying to get an Oscar.
Well, that too. Stallone is someone, though, that is always his style of acting, is I'm going to lean into the thing that makes me most vulnerable. That's how Stallone seems to kind of rationalize serious acting, is I'm going to be sad sack here, or... Yeah, the difference between Rambo Stallone and Stallone when he's like, you know, okay, this is the time to act. I watched Copland for the first time. I don't know if you've ever seen Copland. It was, but that's an example of a Stallone performance where it's like, he's like the quiet, dignified, good guy, local sheriff. And he's the big hero of the movie, but it's really like, he's really quiet and he's really sad, and it's kind of unusual. That's what he always does. Cruise, I could never imagine, even going into this and knowing, okay, there is an element of, like, I had seen trailers, he's going to come back, he's going to train Academy cadets. I still didn't think it was going to kind of head on tackle as much of the idea of, hey, Tom Cruise is getting old. Now, it's not a five-star movie for me. It's very close, but it chickens out in ways that are not entirely surprising. That I thought it was, at one point I thought it was going to go to, and I was like, you know, do it, be the movie that does it, like, be that bold, because you've set up like an earned emotional payoff that's real. You've also set up characters that I think people will like. You know where I'm going. I don't think it's a bold take. I don't think it's.
Is this a Viagra take or is this something else?
No.
Oh, okay. I thought you were talking about something. Okay.
Are we just spoilers? Will I just say what it is? Like, are we?
Yeah. We're spoiling everything. Go ahead.
I mean, like, when his plane goes down, they could have just killed him.
Oh, okay. I got you. Yeah.
That's a really earned, like, emotional moment for a character that wasn't there for. And I wasn't dissatisfied with how they worked their way out of that. Like, it led to some other good things. But I was like, oh, wow, you could really do, like... I won't spoil another movie that people might have seen, but there is another major franchise that has done this moment and not done it anywhere near as well as it could have been done here. I do think it's fascinating that this is, like, the Tom Cruise is getting old movie, and he leaned into that. I think it shows in his acting. Like, he's no less the action star, but it's like, you can feel something of like, you know, if you watch the Clint Eastwood movie when he was aging true, and you're like, okay, I wonder how much longer this could be a thing. Now, of course, Clint Eastwood has proven, it can be a thing a lot longer if you just decide never to let it go, which maybe that's Cruise. Like, he hasn't shown the interest at all to be like, oh, I'm just going to be, you know, a supporting character in some big director's movie. It's not going to happen.
But it's crazy to me because, and you know, I think there's a baseline understanding of his personal life, and there are even documentaries and whatever else. I'm not going to get into all that. But like, there's an understanding that people feel like he's kind of an alien, right?
Yeah.
Like, forget that. Like for a lot of reasons. I mean, and for a lot of, like, for the stunts, for everything, just for his type A, just that he's observes other people, but he doesn't kind of know human emotion. It's like kind of observed, but just whatever you want to say about that. Like Kimmel and Carolla tell this story about like Tom Cruise showed up at one of the Super Bowl parties and showed up and was completely nice and like baked brownies because like that's what you do. And they're like, well, that's not what you do, but it was awesome because it's Tom Cruise. Like everybody describes him as somebody who like means to be nice. I mean, other than the other stuff, but just like an alien. I'm only bringing to talk about the alienness of all of us.
That's what probably talk about offline.
Yes, oh, that's completely offline.
We're talking about Cruise aging, and you're talking about being an alien.
Dude! John Hamm, incredibly handsome man, lets Gray be in his hair, and it's fine because he's still John Hamm. He still looks great. Tom Cruise, his hair is as black as shoe polish, and so there's still kind of this thing of like, he looks young. I'm sure he doesn't eat any meat. I'm sure he has one meal of chicken breast a day. And
he had his shirt off at the start of this movie. And like, yes, he does not look like a man who's with 60. So yes, I'm sure he lives a pretty crazy, fanatical life in terms of diet and fitness.
And you can see it in his face. And even, and I'm not obviously not a connoisseur of this either, but like, I'm sure all these guys, I had this thought about the plastic surgery that other people seem to have, and it looks like it lets him age without, like, his nose is still there. He's always looked like Tom Cruise. So whatever little Botox-y kind of things I'm sure people do, it looks like his face. It's always looked like his face. It looks like his very thin, gaunt, I don't eat a lot face. He looks great for 60. Put some gray in that hair, dude. Like, they got people who can do that for you to show you aging. His hair is so black, and it's like, have you ever seen the dudes who, like, there's a lot more of this in Arizona where the dudes just like basically shoe polish their mustache. And so it'd be like a balding 68-year-old like Mexican cowboy, but his mustache is just as black as just night. That's kind of a thing.
Have you seen pictures of what Tom Cruise looks like in Collateral?
Yeah. Yeah, where you're right. That's all white.
He's got snow white hair. And honestly, he looks weird.
The gray suit, it's like gray suit, white
gray shirt, suit kind of, and gray hair, but it's beyond the kind of silver.
I guess you're right. Steve Martin.
But it's funny that he'll do it like he do it in a sense of, oh, well, of course, I'm not gray. My hair is not white, but I'll do it. Like,
I'll do it for my character. Michael Mann.
Yeah, everyone will know it's just for the character. Where at this point, they'll be like, oh, yeah, he's just decided Maverick will have some gray hairs. Everyone will be like, oh, Tom Cruise is old. So, yeah, the movie is about him being old, which takes a lot of concessions on his part in terms of ego. But in terms of vanity, there's no concessions whatsoever. It's like, yeah, you know, he's still, maybe he's 40. Maybe that's what he's willing to concede kind of age-wise.
It's just striking to me. And again, it's striking to me. And again, this goes to the kind of the feel-goodness of this. I'm just going to be honest. I always struggle to find people who articulate this kind of thing about likable characters doing well without having the whole long conversation. Although, of course, I'm an OG Star Wars fan, so of course I feel some of this. But like, I want to listen to a podcast that talks about this kind of stuff or a YouTube video without having to go down the whole thing about woke politics and what this is doing, whatever else. I just want to say every character in this movie I liked. And mm-hmm. I wouldn't say that every movie should be like this. Even at the end, John Hamm gives him the thumbs up or whatever happens at that. You like every single person in this movie. And the bad guys are faceless as they were in the original Top Gun.
It's that is though. Like that's really simple. It's the casting. The casting is incredible. Like there's not a single role that is miscast. And that is part of it. I think it's just like as an audience member, you can detect it. If someone is wrong for the part, you start to resent them. You're like, oh, I don't buy that. I don't believe that guy. I don't want to hear what they have to say. I think that's something that just kind of happens where there is not one person. Like, obviously, we've talked about Glenn Powell. Miles Teller, I don't know how much you know about, like, Miles Teller and his reputation in Hollywood. He is known to be one of the most difficult and widely disliked people in Hollywood.
Well, he is Aaron Rodgers' best friend.
He went on vacation. But he is, that is kind of like, I have no idea if it's true or not, but that is like the book is out and that's how it reads. You know, that's his reputation. But he's really well cast and he can act. And in multiple movies, he has shown he can act. But it's, you can kind of go down all across the casting from people like Jay Ellis, who I've seen in Insecure before, really good actor. He's Payback, I think, is his call sign. Monica Barbaro, who's Phoenix. I do not know if she's ever been in anything before. I'd never seen her, never heard of her. Just fantastic. Like, and I think that mix of being able to kind of slot people in and you're like, okay, well, I've seen that person there. There's someone I knew as an up and comer and this is going to take them to another level. And then there's people like, I have no idea who that is, but it doesn't matter. Like they don't stand out any more or less within the movie. That helps you to root for all these people because they feel like real characters. Like it's down to casting more than anything, but also the script working is the factor there too. And there is just something that's really interesting with like the original. I find the stakes to be really low and I can't even remember. I've seen it multiple times. If you were to give me specifics of like, what is the threat and what exactly, I'd be like, I don't know.
Yeah.
I can think of like the internal conflicts, like the locker room kind of head to head scenes. But I can't think of the bigger threat. And of course, the interesting thing with that, and we see it here, is across these movies, they're fighting literally nameless, like, threats.
Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, there are countless countries you could call it. And generally in movies, in spite of the fact it's not great for your international box office, they do pin a country and are like, you know, these are the bad guys. And in this, we get nothing. Even the landscape is nondescript enough that it's like, oh, this could be anywhere.
They're G.I. Joe and they're fighting Cobra. Somebody said it was obvious. Like, oh, this is, I didn't feel like this was obvious that they were in Russia or anything like that. They're fighting nowhere.
It could very easily, with everything that's there, it could very easily be Russia. But there is also nothing there that makes it like it can only be Russia. And I think also, obviously, at the moment, there's ways that people are only into that. But this film was made 3 years ago. And they've actually, I've seen kind of quotes from Cruz. I've heard Kaczynski talk about it. And they're like, yeah, well, we're making a movie and we want the movie to one hold up over time. It's like, yeah, right now people could say, oh yeah, if that was Russia, that would make a lot of sense. And people would be like, but what does that look like in 20 years? You know, how does that play then? And I think that's kind of smart when you're making again, like you just want the biggest possible audience and you want a crowd pleaser. you kind of make a movie where, yeah, there's a bad guy, we don't know who they are. Yeah, there are, you know, I guess slightly villainous characters, but they're not really villains. We like all of them. It's like, it's very difficult to pull that off. Like, it goes against all of the rules of you sit down to write your screenplay. You've got to have, okay, well, what is the thing? There isn't that major pull. Like, there isn't the pull factor where you're like, okay, well, this is what Tom Cruise is up against. Really, Tom Cruise is up against authority. He's up against aging. And that's, we're just cheering for him. And it allows him to defy that easier. It allows these big, like, crowd-pleasing moments where the opening scene and then again later is just like, he just openly defies orders.
Him showing up to run the course. Because, you know where it's going to end. You know they're going to run this course. And my brain, I'm not doing the math, but my brain's doing the math. I don't care. Like, I figured, and I was pleased that Glenn Powell comes back at the end. Because I was thinking, okay, obviously in Top Gun 1, Maverick is on reserve and he flies out. And I'm like, okay, so now we're going to get, and I was used to your kind of thought of the third tier of a movie, the third act, where it's like, okay, now they're going to launch everybody at the end. So we're going to see these other fighters. And I thought they were going to go that way because we know there are other fighters, so they're going to get out of there. Somebody's going to get shot down. And in my brain, just in a split second, I'm like, they're going to launch all these other characters that we like to do the third act firefight. And they didn't do that part. But I was thinking of something else when he shows up to run that test run. And I just thought that was perhaps the most satisfying little moment of just the little moments like they just hit. And I think maybe later, maybe it's when they actually do it, where they actually do the second part of the second miracle of the bomb, and the bomb goes right in the hole. And it was just, and look, I'm not in a great sound, not in a great big screen, but it was just like a yes, you know.
Yeah, it really is. It just captures that. And that's what you're seeing on screen. Like, you've got the control room and you've got that, and that's what it feels like in the theater. I think that Glenn Powell moment at the end is a really great call because watching it in the moment, it's not like all movie, I'm like, oh, well, they're sidelining him to come back then. But in, we'll say, the 30 seconds before that happens, I was like, oh, okay, this is Glenn Powell's moment. But not in a way where I'm like, oh, okay, I can see where this is going. The thing they've done is they set up Glenn Powell to be likable enough that you're like, yeah, it makes sense. That is the right payoff. And that's what I also want to see. Like, it's the right ending for the movie, but it's also what I want to see as the audience member. I don't want him to be left out of this. You know, he's clearly the best pilot of all of them, other than Maverick. So you want to see him involved in it. So that's, again, like, that's really, it's something that you can just kind of talk about and having experienced it. But to actually do that is so difficult.
It just be. And so, and because, and you know, I love nostalgia. I'm sure I love nostalgia more than you. But there's something about, you know, fan service, and there's a whole conversation around fan service and in the context of.
Are we going to talk about something else in a minute?
We can. We'd love to. I'd love to. But there's a pretty good feeling of, oh, that's the thing I know, right? Mm-hmm. That's the thing I know. And a lot of times that's like a 7. Sometimes it's like a 4. You know, I'm going to say the line in Rogue One, you know, they run into Ponda Baba, and it's kind of funny that he bumps into the guy and Ponda Baba says, get out of the way. But it's you're like, okay, that's another category of fan service. It's like, hey, we're showing you this thing that you know, and it's kind of an Easter egg, and people chuckle or they don't. But because this movie had me in such a trance that then I feel like it hit, like, dude, yo, he's like, talk to me, dad. Like, we've been here at talk to me, goose. And he's like, talk to me, dad. And I'm like, oh, these
but
little
that's,
beats.
That's not even the fan service, though. Like, Rogue One is interesting.
Right, you're right. It's more of a callback.
Because that Rogue One example you give is actually the kind of nostalgia that this movie really deals in, which is, one, it's early and often. Mm. And then it gets out of the way. And it can pull on your heartstrings in a way because of, quite literally, the kind of the ghost of Goose just kind of like hanging over the movie. And then those moments will evoke that for you. But it's not really playing with remember this from Top Gun in the same way from about after the first act, you know?
Yeah.
Or probably after the Val Kilmer scene, yeah. I think that is the moment where it says, okay, well, this is where we move on. Like, it comes straight out of the gate and it gives you the opening titles like exactly as they were. Like you cannot hit you any harder with like, yeah, remember Top Gun? You love Top Gun. Here's the music. Here's the titles. And at that point, I'm shifting to my seat. I'm like, oh no, what have I done?
Yeah.
But it's smart enough to lay that on tick and then just move out of the way and be like, that's what people are here for. That's why they care about this to begin with. But now we've also got to get them to care about why they're here now and who the characters are. Like it's enough to use that and you get people in the door and it's right to give them something. But at a certain point, you've got to build something new. It can have echoes of what's been done before. Mm. Like, I don't know how you feel about this. One of the comparisons that I have heard and seen for this movie is there are some strong Force Awakens elements to how they're kind of going about this story, but I do think it diverges more. Like, and ultimately, I think that's to its favor. And I quite like a lot of things about Force Awakens, but in looking back, it'd be like, oh yeah, would it have been cool if they did a lot of the things they did, mm-hmm. but then they just moved on right there and then? Then they just gave us something where we're like, okay, that is all what I know from before, but this is something new. Like, that's where you're engaging a different part of an audience's brain. You're creating new expectations, and you're giving the possibility to, like, surprise or to create the tension yeah. that this movie, like, lives on. The fact that, late on, you're properly invested in all of it. And in all of the characters, new characters who we just met.
So, just listening back to this now, another comparison I suppose you could make is when Bob's laser-guided missile tracking thingy goes down. That's not exactly the same thing as Luke switching off his targeting computer purposefully, but it does raise the stakes, and it's an interesting comparison that I just thought of.
And you're thinking in real time, I'm thinking of all these different variations. First of all, the Glenn Powell thing. Him getting benched and then rooting for them to do well on the bench. I'm like, he's coming off the bench like PJ Tucker or somebody. Like, we're like, okay, you'd like that. We're like, okay, that's
Bobby. Last year's Bobby Portis.
Yeah, he's last year's Bobby Portis. He's like, oh yeah, he was. And I'm like, oh okay, yeah.
The Brooklyn
yeah,
that's series, right. And he's gonna be yeah. good come Phoenix.
He's like, I love this guy. You're like, he's, and you're just like, oh, okay, I love all these guys, right? The inversion isn't the word. Because, okay, they're doing the Miles Teller plot about he's not going fast enough. And so there's one way to write that where it's like, well, he's going to be right too. They're both going to be right. By the way, he's Goose's son. And you know, there's more than one way to do it. Let's get here safe. There's more than one way to kind of rock this thing. He's going to come up in some kind of way when they come out of the trench, be smart. Or do it some other kind of way. So then no, when he just decides to open up his engines and they say engage, which of course is a callback to Top Gun 1, he's like, it's like, oh, he's re-engaged. And I'm like, oh, they did that. And it's like, oh, Maverick's re-engaging. And it also very satisfying because it just, everything I didn't see coming, I loved. And everything I saw coming, I loved. But yeah, just the little kind of beats of like, okay, this is mini arc. And he forgives Tom Cruise during the football game, which I'm glad they explained because I don't know how that would work. But then he doesn't forgive him later, and they take the time to do all this, why he hates them, and some of that went a little bit long for me. And by the way, the weirdest scene to me, because I saw it in the trailer, but like Tom Cruise freaking out and having this kind of flashback dump as Miles Teller plays the piano, and then they just remember all the other movies, and it's like, yeah, we know he died, like mm-hmm. everyone here knows. I mean, maybe not the, you know, to be fair, I'm sure you don't get this quite the same way in Ireland. Memorial Day week, and we had I'm at a 4 o'clock show. It was quite a lot of veteran looking dudes there.
Yeah, I'm sure.
Yeah, quite a lot. Just kind of quiet, shirts tucked in. Were in their seats when no one else was in their seats. Kind of like there was a lot of those dudes in the bathroom.
If they're not at Top Gun, they're not at anything. Like I'm not surprised at that.
Yeah. All right, I want to talk about a couple other things. What, anything else on Top Gun, man?
No, I really loved it.
I loved it.
One thing, I don't know if you got this. I was trying to remember what I got a kind of preview thing before, so I didn't get that Tom Cruise introduction thing. But in recent weeks, and the only thing in my mind I can think that it probably played before was Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. There was, I saw that in IMAX, and there was like a, you know, it was specifically, you know, here is your IMAX, you know, teaser for Top Gun Maverick, and Cruise says something that goes into it. And it's the sequence, which I think is the only sequence in the movie that does not quite work. And when I saw it out of context, I was like, is this movie going to be a complete mess? It's one of the first kind of flight sequences where everyone is doing their exercises, and it where it's leading, you know, there's the, they all end up doing push-ups because they're not. Cruise is kind of pulling all these maneuvers, and he's getting to a place where he's getting the kills that they're trying to avoid. And The Who's Won't Get Fooled Again is playing. And it's, the editing is all over the place. And that's just a classic example. Great song, like great place you could find for it in the movie. But I was like, oh no, they're going to do the thing that they did with Top Gun with this as well. And they're just going to put music everywhere. It's so weird because when you see the movie, I think it stands out like a sore thumb. And you're like, oh yeah, it really does feel like something they just put in. They're like, yeah, we'll just take that 5-minute clip out and we'll play it before things in IMAX as a promo for the weeks ahead. But that's to circle back to something that's, I guess, kind of simple, but I said to lead off. I think the music is, to me, the most important thing here, because you get like the gong, you get the iconic motifs from Top Gun that people are there from. Are there for, but it lays out completely. You get a lot more time with no music in this movie, and you get Zimmer doing much more subtle work with the score than you had with the original. And I don't know, maybe people who just like don't think about movies as much as I do, I don't know if everyone realizes like just how much score can ruin a good movie. Like, just completely ruin. Score isn't even the word, because it could be soundtrack music. Sometimes you just gotta let the movie breathe. You've got to let what's on the screen speak for itself. You've got to trust in what you've done, and as a writer, as a director. And this movie does that in ways that I don't think the original was prepared to do. And maybe the acting is better this time around as well, so you're in a better position to do that. But I do think it paid off. Like, there's just so much confidence in this movie. That probably comes from Cruise being like, yeah, I know how to make a $160 million movie that's going to gross $800 million minimum, no problem. Maybe that just trickles down and that's what it is, but that is so rare. And it really is, you go see, you're like, yeah, I'm in a safe pair of hands and this is really enjoyable. Like, I have yet to see anyone, like critics, anyone I know who's seen it, just like scrolling Twitter, any tweets I see where someone's like, hey, that movie, the movie's bad.
How could
that,
you?
Never happens. It never happens that no one has that take. Like, I'm unbelievably impressed by just the ability to make this film as successfully as they've done.
Somewhere, someone is, right now it occurred to me, taking a bootleg of his scene with Jennifer Connelly and putting Take My Breath Away from Top Gun on it. Just one of the funniest songs. Like, there's a few kind of 80s songs that are just kind of funny, but it's just so, it's not. Top 5 cheesy 80s or 80s adjacent songs that never fail to make me laugh. These are perfect songs, perfect imperfections. Number 5, Berlin, Take My Breath Away. Number 4. I don't know much, but I know I love you. And that may be all I need to know. Aaron Neville and Linda Ronstadt. Aaron Neville, one of the funniest, I guess a good voice, a very good voice, but just one of the funniest voices of all time, and in the middle of kind of 80s, 90s ballad cheese. Try to smile. If you sing along and try not to smile, you cannot do it. It's just the funniest. It should be number 1. Number 3. Very clear.
here as we're both lying here. There's so many things I want to say. I will always love you. I would never leave you alone.
Peter Cetera, The Glory of Love. Now, let's be very clear. I'm not making fun of any of these songs. Maybe the, maybe a couple of them. I love this song. And as I'm listening to this, this does kind of have a little bit of that kind of classic 80s, Sister Christian motoring kind of build resolve, the drums build kind of resolve thing. But from the Karate Kid Part 2, where he goes to Asia and Miyagi-san has an old beef with another guy who's gonna some kind of blood feud that he has to resolve, and then some kind of way Miyagi is gonna fight this guy to the death, but there's a hurricane and something falls on the bad guy's chest, and so Miyagi is going to karate chop the guy in the chest, and the guy thinks he's going to finish it, but Miyagi was never going to kill the guy, and so like breaks the load-bearing beam that's fallen on his chest, and everything's okay. And then now his evil Sith, you know, disciple has to fight Daniel-san for stealing his girl. And, of course, at the end of that movie, Daniel-san learns from the dial that everyone's using how to throw a right and then throw a left and then throw a right. And I'm killing time because I want to hear more of this song. But number three, Peter Cetera, Glory of Love. Number two. Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go. Perfect, kind of a perfect pop song. Perfect in Zoolander. Perfect George Michael. I have nothing to add. Which brings us to number one. Drum roll, please. That's right, Top Gun, not one, but two iconic tracks in the top five, which is not even mentioning other great tracks from Top Gun. One of the most 80s movies of all time. And again, Adam, a little bit younger, doesn't quite understand this. It's totally fine. He can rip it. Yes, it's a wall of sound. But like, listen to this song. Like, listen, we used to be a proper country, right? Like, this is just... Kenny Loggins. So obviously, like, this has, in so much as it's his vocals, has a little bit of that kind of Caddyshack charm also. But like, what do you want me to talk intelligently about this? Listen to it. It's Playing with the Boys. The GOAT. The GOAT cheesy 80s song in perhaps the GOAT cheesy 80s scene, a volleyball scene out of nowhere. Tremendous. Playing with the Boys.
I guess for people who like cheese, there wasn't...
You know what? Cheese, you know what bugs me in Top Gun? You know what bugs me in Top Gun?
Tell me, of all the music. Tell me.
Sitting on the Dock of a Bay does not belong in that movie. When Otis Redding is playing on the radio, it's like, what? Why are you doing this? You're killing me with Kenny Loggins, like, relentlessly for so long. And then you think it's just cool to just, like, throw Otis Redding in here and pretend that this is where Otis Redding belongs and all the rest of this. It's like this moment of, like, one, it is a moment they're trying to have a character moment, which I'd argue, you know, take the music out. Take the music out. Let them have a moment that people could be like, oh, yeah. But instead, you're using an all-time great song, and it just feels completely out of place.
The first time I ever heard that song. Right. I don't think it...
In Top Gun?
Because it was 86. I mean, I was 6 years old. My dad... Certainly not for Top Gun, but the first movie I remember, I want to say 5 foot tall twin speakers he got, and we watched Top Gun and played this like it was really like a supreme kind of cool dad moment where you got these huge speakers and we hooked it up, and I'm sure it was certainly still VHS, and just blasted this movie like as loud as it could get.
Do you think you're capable of separating Top Gun from that?
But I don't want to. It's a wonderful moment. Don't inside out this great memory.
No, that's a great moment. That's the kind of, you know, foundational memory we all have about one thing or another. I was just curious as to whether you think that is, and I get that. I'd have movies, no doubt, or things that are like, they're associated with the moment, they're associated with the feeling, which are about more than the movie. And I get Top Gun, like, was one of those experiences, like, actually even quite literally that kind of experience for a lot of people, just because it's the time it came out as well. But no, I was just curious.
And also so you being younger, you know, there was no internet, but I mean, even later, right? So you have an idea, bro. You have this idea of stuff that you pick up on, but there's no way to really know. I can't tell you when I figured out, you'll hate this, but like, I think you'll know what I'm saying. So, you know, the Bruckheimer logo.
Mm-hmm.
And we watched these movies 100 times, but I can't tell you when I actually figured out that Tony Scott and Michael Bay were different people, because they were just people making these kinetic movies. So,
sure.
And I'm like, I'm not you.
No, but I get that too. I mean, don't underestimate. I'm not so young not to be at that point. I'm pre-internet too, and the Bruckheimer thing is a really strong example.
Yes.
Because I can think of, like, throughout the 90s even, like, watching movies, and it would be, even if it's not just, like, the production, if it's like that, if it's, like, the studio, like, if I think of, like, the TriStar logo or the Columbia or obviously Universal, like, they're the things that in your head, like, particularly, I obviously it's not the case that nobody knew directors, but there wasn't, like, unless you were a cinephile, with someone, like, introduce you to that, and you're going to the library and reading a ton of books on it. I mean, the average person is going to process movies much more true. What are the logos that come up? And am I seeing that logo before multiple things I really like? So that makes a lot of sense too, that you're seeing like those kind of directors where you get some crossover and you're like, oh, it's another Bruckheimer movie. You're not thinking,
yeah,
is the director a different person?
Exactly.
It doesn't factor
you're just
in
like,
at all.
You're like, I can't believe how cool the camera looks spinning around Will Smith and Martin Lawrence. And you start to pick up that it's in different movies and you forget who did which one, but you're just like, at this time period, you know, and of course I was all in on Will Smith at the time period. Obviously too, but you're just like, this is cool. The clothes are cool. This Lamborghini going through San Francisco is awesome. Whatever movie you happen to be watching. And so that style.
Honestly, that's still the case.
Yeah.
You've got to be a certain kind of person to care more. Cause like, if you want to take two extremes of it, you've got people and they see the Marvel logo, they see the DC logo, or they see like Lucasfilm, whatever it is, and they're like, oh yeah, this is what it is. Don't care who's directing it. And then even if you go to like independent, like A24, there's an entire cult around A24 where people just treat A24 movies as A24 movies. Like it's not about like that. That's such a broad thing. You've got directors who could be in their 70s and you've got directors who could be in their 20s. That still is, I think it's, there is a level of, oh, I really like movies, but I don't really care to think about it. I've never thought about, you know, the people behind the movie and how it actually gets done, where there is always that element of, that's the logo. I see the logo. That's the visual thing that hits me as a kind of signifier of, oh, well, someone made this movie. Who made it? Well, it's that logo. You know, it's those people. So that is interesting, but I think even like for people like you or I, where in the past, well, that was the case. Then you move on. It's like, okay, we now have the internet, and it's, if you're the kind of person who just wants to know a little bit more, you kind of fall into the rest of it. But it's still kind of the case, which is interesting.
But the Packers were in. I want to answer your Force Awakens question too. The Packers were in the '96. NFC championship game, or it was the next year, but they kept beating the Niners, and they played the Niners, and this goes to the Zimmerness of it, and they played the Zimmer score from The Rock or whatever it would have been.
Fox. Lombardi once stood upon this spot, known around the NFL as Camelot, and in his frozen kingdom, championships were as common as the chill in the air. Now, on this legendary field, a man named Favre has been knighted and is ready to carve a championship, fighting with his mighty sword to return Green Bay's glory back to this palace made from ice, where the fans live in legend with comrades of chill, and Reggie believes his fate is sculpted in snowy scripture. But the team of here and now is Carolina as they chisel away at their own fate. The NFL's new breed of cool cats are in a ferocious hurry for some history of their own. And today, they look to thaw this NFL giant. Like a clean sheet of ice, 2 years ago, Capers chipped away a divisional champ. And with a swarming, charging D, they scratched and clawed their way to creating some living legends of their own. Before Super Bowls were played, there was the Packers and the man named Lombardi who sculpted and molded this sacred grail. Today, championship play returns to the icy purity of Lambeau, and today's victor gets a chance to play for the ultimate championship and claim this trophy as their own.
It's been nearly 30 years since the sun shone over Green Bay for a championship game, but this year
the
Packers
preview
have
pregame
the dawn
preview
of a new
awesome. They probably are now too, and I just don't watch them. But it was like, oh wow, they're setting it off with this that this kind of marchy kind of martial kind of score from The Rock or whichever one it would have been, and it was all kind of a piece of all of those kind of, you know, all of those kind of movies of that time period. Where you're just like, so to me, this meant kineticism. And it started with Top Gun, you know, and then later on, at a certain point, I did understand, okay, there's Tony Scott and Ridley Scott and there are these people. But like at the time, it was the Bruckheimer logo that just was like the stamp of a certain kind of thing before Bay took it to this logical extreme. But like all of those movies, I didn't see all of them, but like, some of them got replayed on TV after a while, but it was just like, it just meant something different coming out of the 80s. Into kind of this 90s kind of thing was what that meant.
On Zimmer, just on you mentioning Zimmer there, did you know going into this that Zimmer had any involvement? Did you know while watching it that Zimmer had any involvement? Or did you hear and be like, that's Zimmer? Or did you just not think about it at all until I came
because I'm still not as good as you with this. Like,
I know you're a Zimmer guy. I know I've heard you talk about many Christopher Nolan movies, and you can't talk about Christopher Nolan movies without talking about Zimmer and talking about, you know, what's your favorite Zimmer score?
No, I didn't, and I should have, but that's also not how I engage yourself later. Like, there's, and also once you stop making Bucks videos and stuff like that, you're not looking for, like, I remember, it just doesn't, like, so I'm the guy, even with rock music, it's kind of like this. Like, I don't think I've ever really we had this conversation off channel, me and the fellas, the other day. Like, I don't actually, I know that white people and rock fans and everything was like, I'm aware that Radiohead was the thing for 20 years. But because I didn't want, because I'm from the 80s and I didn't watch those music videos, then I know of Creep and I've heard a couple others. And then you play another couple others and it's like, oh, I have heard those. I like those.
Yeah. Yeah.
But the entire time, like, people were, this was true with the Black Keys of kind of other stuff, but I'm visual, right? Like, I know the Guns N' Roses songs because those were videos and because of Terminator 2 and because of all, like, yeah. I know the stuff that was in movies. But when people,
which is also what, you know, Creep for Radiohead, for example, because yes, exactly. The video yeah. was a big deal.
Yes. But I can't, I think the way our brains are just kind of, and I'm just not that big of a music fan. I mean, we say that too. I mean, other people I'm sure do that. But like, to me, when you see something, there was very much, this is East Coast, West Coast rap. There's a whole bunch of other stuff. But when everything was MTV, you wouldn't understand this form of white music or this form of country music or this form of anything else unless it had this awesome video. Beck was like this. A lot of stuff was like this. And then you're just like, oh, okay, I understand, right? Oh, the Beastie Boys are back. Oh, they're doing this other weird thing. But it had to have visuals with sound if it's just a guitar lick. But of course, Top Gun is a movie that proves how much I love a guitar lick, because a well-placed guitar lick is really cheesy and awesome, right? And of course, I forget where I was going with this. But like, I just think visuals divorced from a certain kind of audio doesn't really hit me the same kind of way. But then when you hear it then you're just like, oh, I love all of this kind of stuff. But it was the second Blade Runner, and I was looking for music for a Bucks video, and people are like, or it just got referred to me, you should listen to the Blade Runner 2 score. Or maybe you said it. I don't know. Somebody said it. But divorced from actually having watched that movie, which I haven't watched that movie, it just kind of, I didn't give it a chance, but also it just doesn't hit me without having had an emotional response to it in a theater and then working backwards from there.
Sure. I listen to score music all the time, but never, ever have I listened to the score of a movie I haven't seen.
Okay. Okay.
So that makes sense to me. And I couldn't even imagine just being like, oh, I hear the score is really good. If I heard that, I'd probably be like, oh, I want to see the movie first. I want to see how the score works within the movie, but probably by like how my brain works, which probably ties into your idea of it too. It's, you know, particularly when you're talking about music for film, I mean, they work in tandem. It's not just music. It's music for certain visuals. But whenever the day comes, and I've no doubt, given you like it so much, that the day will come when you watch Top Gun Maverick again. Now that you know Zimmer is involved, you will hear Zimmer. Like,
okay.
He never takes over the movie. He's doing the subtle work, like, which is, I admire, because that's not usually the term I'd come to use when it would come to Hans Zimmer. But you hear it and you're like, oh, it is actually really elevating the movie. I'm saying that as someone that's not like Hans Zimmer is my favorite composer, but it's undeniable that like when he's on, he's on. Like,
when he's on, he's on.
Yeah.
And I'm a big hack. I just like big hacks kind of in general. And so to me, kind of the whole pipe organ thing for Interstellar, where it's like, wow, they're really laying this on thick, but just to do such big, just such a, that could have really not worked. There's a lot of stuff that could really, and I'm always the kind of guy who's like, wow, I really appreciate the brassiness of hitting us in the face with so
the
much.
The best part of that though in Interstellar is how, for how big it is also how small it is. Like, yeah. That's what Zimmer does best, is dynamics. And that's why I think here, he does the thing that I hated. He gets rid of the thing I hated about the first one, because he knows the big is already there. So he's like, okay, well, if I'm here to add my usual dynamics, I can't go there because someone else has already done that. I've got to find all of the softer moments, the softer tones that are going to round it out. I've talked way too much about the score, but it's the thing that when I think of Top Gun, I think about the music, and I think that's probably true for everyone. I just think about it in a really negative way, and I don't have that association with this movie at all. I think it's a big deal with everything else. I think it's a very conscious decision. I think it's one of those things where I'm sure, like, how happy was Cruise really that the Top Gun soundtrack was a phenomenon and something that people talked about beyond the time? It's like, you want it to work within the film, but you don't want people years later to be like, oh, I'm still listening to the Top Gun soundtrack, but I haven't watched the movie in years. Mm-hmm. I think there's something interesting at play in that too. But that's enough for me on the music.
Okay, 5 minutes on two other things then. We love Top Gun.
And this is the part where the narrator says it was not indeed 5 minutes on two other things. It was at least another hour. So we'll put that out sometimes in the future. I have kind of found that if I put two episodes kind of back to back, then maybe that's just too much of me in a short setting. So maybe, I don't know, we'll put that out sometime, maybe later in the week. The officiating the Celtics got was ridiculous. That's all I'll say about that. Jimmy Butler deserved to take that shot. It was the best shot you could have gotten there. That's all I have to say about that. And we'll touch base sometimes in the future. We'll touch base at some point. Or not. And if this podcast is actually wrapping up, I think it's been a really fun couple of years, and I appreciate all the fun and all the enemies we've made around the way. Speaking of which, I want to end with this, and so I didn't want to put any music underneath this because I didn't want to seem disrespectful. I got a really nice message about the video last year, and I'm just going to read this verbatim. I just think it's really sweet and touching and moving. And let me find it here, and I'm going to read this, and then we'll say goodbye. Jacob Anderson sent this message to the YouTube. He said, I could use this, so I'm going to read it. So he watched the video, and he says, wow, not ashamed to say, I'm in tears right now. In November of 2020, I lost my best friend and brother to cancer. In his last moments, I leaned in next to him and whispered in his ear. I told him I loved him, and that one day our stupid Bucks were going to win that elusive title, and that I'd be in the building, and he'd be with me. 8 months later, I cried like a baby as those final seconds ticked off. I left some of his ashes near my seats. He was with me and all of us. Other than my children being born, that was the best day of my life. This piece so perfectly encapsulates how much that moment meant to me and countless others. Thank you so, so much for this. Bucks and Six. Rest in power, Chuck. This has been Titonia World Presents. Thanks for listening.